Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this session with Josh Corrigan. I don't think I need to introduce Josh. After yesterday, he's well known to everybody. The paper is, in fact, a very interesting paper, and I think follows on from some of the subtle comments you dropped yesterday during the session. It's particularly interesting because we've moved forward, I think, from the little pyramids that we were building in risk management now to understanding this thing is much more dynamic. So, Josh? Sorry, one more thing. If you're going to ask questions, please use the mic and state your name.
Thanks, John. Just before I start, just an apologies. I was meant to be jointly presenting this session with Neil Allen, co-author of the paper. He's a professor at the University of Bath and Bristol's in the UK, and unfortunately had a last-minute change of plan and couldn't actually get on the flight to make this event. So you've just got me. But anyway, I hope to do this topic justice. I guess, has anyone, just by way of a show of hands, has anyone actually looked at the paper? One, two, okay, three, maybe? Okay, no worries. I expect you to read it afterwards. I hope that I'll give you a bit of an overview today. This doesn't seem to be working. Okay. Right, so I'll talk a little bit about... Sorry, could I just ask you to close the doors, if that's possible? So I'll talk a little bit about what is emerging risk and why should we care, and then go into some emerging assessment methods for thinking about how we can quantify it, or at least put in place a process to get our heads around it. Okay, this buzzer is not working. Okay, so I'll start out with a few definitions. So these are definitions that we see published by a number of insurance organisations. So Lloyd's says it's an issue. Emerging risk is an issue that is perceived to be potentially significant, but which may not be fully understood or allow for on insurance terms and conditions, pricing, reserving, or capital setting. Swiss Re says it's a new or already known risk which are difficult to assess and which may have a major impact on an organisation. And the IAA says that emerging risks are developing already known risks which are subject to uncertainty and ambiguity and are therefore difficult to quantify using traditional risk assessment techniques. So what's common across all of those? Well, I think first and foremost, emerging risk is something that we don't fully understand. We don't understand completely the timing. The significance of it may be important, it may not be. You know, the bottom line is that at the time in which you're trying to assess it, there's a huge amount of uncertainty around the timing, the frequency, and the severity of these types of risks. And that it's not necessarily all that unknown. You know, we're not dealing in the Donald Rumsfeld's unknown unknowns here. Sometimes these are known unknowns or unknown knowns, if that makes sense. So getting some perspective on what those look like is what I'm trying to talk to you about today. I guess first and foremost, why do we actually care about emerging risk? Why should we care? I think the session yesterday around strategic risk was actually really insightful. It was really interesting and quite insightful because, you know, there you've got futurists trying to look out 5+ years where the nature of the dynamics of what's going on is very, very uncertain. And that's all about thinking about scenarios in which my business might be in. In the same way, we can think about emerging risks in the same context. You know, when we scan out on the horizon, what potential scenarios might our organization be subject to? And so for things... For work involving Pillar 2, where we're trying to think about holistic risk assessment, we're trying to look at stress and scenario tests. We want to try and pinpoint and frame some of those scenario tests with respect to those emerging risks, not just the risks that we already know about, but some of the risks that we might be subject to. I think also emerging risk provides us not just the ability to manage the downside aspects, but it also has a pretty important strategic element to it. To the extent that we can assess emerging risk quicker than our competitors, then I think there's an opportunity aspect there that that is potentially quite useful. So I guess the question is, why are they hard to spot? Well, the issue is there's a universe of possibilities. You can study every science journal. You can scrutinize every news story. You can, you know, employ futurists. But at the end of the day, you know, it's very, very difficult to pick through all of that information and come at a realistic assessment of an emerging risk that is meaningful and potentially significant to my organization. There's a huge amount of challenge in that because you've got to deal with, you know, multiple trends. What scale is the risk operating at is a critical issue. Cognitive biases, insufficient resources, these are huge challenges to the assessment of emerging risk. So having the right perspective is absolutely fundamental. You cannot think about emerging risk just as events. And this is a whole paradigm, I think, that's starting to really change now globally. You know, risk isn't just a crisis. It's not just an event. Risk is the outcome of the system by which we're trying to manage. And so if you try and spot emerging risk by looking at crises and events, you're just going to miss things. You need to look at what the underlying system drivers and dynamics and how those relationships play out and where the tipping points might be to get a much better assessment of where emerging risk might come from. And scale is absolutely critical as well. So thinking about the different scales at which drivers exist within the business and externally to the business. So you've obviously got a number of drivers at the company level, whether competition, operational, capitalization. Thinking about how they interrelate at an industry level through regulation, again, competition, distribution, other agents within the supply chain. And then broadly, you know, society, social changes around behaviors, economics, demographics. These scales which drivers of a business operate at basically move at different speeds. And a lot of times where you get emerging risk coming from is when causal drivers within one scale, typically in the slower scale, reach a critical point of threshold, and they reach a tipping point, and then they cascade down. And that's largely what we saw in the financial crises of 2008. So where I really want to think about emerging risks is at the interaction level between these types of scales, and I really want to have some framework for setting up my indicators and thinking about the nonlinear states in which they may exist. So I don't know if any of you have read the World Economic Forum report. Hands up if you have. A couple, one. Okay, that's very disappointing. Next year I expect you all to have read it when I do the same presentation. If you look at that paper, it's a fascinating paper. Literally, you can freely download it. They've started to move in the direction of thinking about risks as interrelationships and of mapping and thinking about resilience and robustness. This is where risk management is going. And so what you're seeing here is a connectivity map, and this can be constructed. They basically use cognitive approaches, so through surveys and just ask people how they thought things interrelated and the strength of those relationships. You can use data, predictive modeling and data analytics to achieve the same thing, or combinations. And what you're seeing here is combinations of emerging risks that on the biggest scale that we probably operate at on a global scale. And the two most important things here are those risks that are most connected within that system. So they're the most systemic risks. And what you're seeing here is global governance failure and severe income disparity are the most highly connected of those risks. So that's actually really, really important to understand when you try to map these frameworks out. Unlike some of the work that we do, this is kind of a bi-directional connectivity measure. We typically look at unidirectional, so we say what influences what. So we have a directional aspect, so not just speed but velocity as well. So assessment methods, how can we possibly get a framework for thinking about all of this? Well, when we look at things from a systems perspective, basically one of the key insights into that is that risk is, again, it's not an event, it's an outcome of a complex adaptive system. So risk is really a process, and all and any complex adaptive systems are subject to evolutionary processes. They evolve over time. You think about your own organization that you work in. It evolves over time. It's completely different to what it was 10 years ago. And emerging risks are the mechanism by which organizations evolve. And so having a framework, which I'll lead you through in a minute, basically gives us insight into some of these important aspects. It gives us a rigorous classification system, gives us a guide to emerging, dynamic and systemic risk. Emerging and systemic risks are actually quite related. So systemic risk is what's most fundamental. Emerging risk can be fundamental, but typically it's probably at the other end of the scale. It's probably something that is a minor evolution as opposed to a major systemic risk, but they're actually quite related. Risks have an organisational lineage and a history. They're path-dependent. They're not independent. And we can think about the connectivity of different risks. So that'll become a little bit more evident as I walk through this. I'm not going to go through this slide in detail, but needless to say, when we compare the evolution of risk within the context of an organisation, we can draw parallels to biology and linguistics, because both of those sciences have very similar properties around how they change and evolve over time. And by studying these sciences and the techniques that those scientists use, we can start to bring some of those approaches into risk management. So one of the techniques that biologists love is a technique called cladistics, or it's otherwise called phylogenetics. I don't know if anyone heard of that term before. I'm getting some nods, a couple of nods. Yep. Basically, cladistics is the study of how different things are interrelated. And by things in a biologist context, they mean living or ex-living dead things. And so what you're seeing here is what's called a cladogram. And this is a famous one. This is the cladogram of life. You know, it shows how all living things are related to one another. And so the question is, well, you know, when biologists are faced with that problem of you've got so many different things and you want to understand how they're all interrelated, how can you possibly do that? Well, one of the ways in which you can do it is by assessing characteristics. So black swans... I'm sure all of you know the history of black swans and why they're famous. But black swans are nothing more. When we look at a cladistic view of it and characteristics of black swans, you could say a black swan is a swan that is black. And in the UK, we had swans, which were white. But we also had other birds, which were black. And we had other birds, which were black and white. So we'd seen both of those characteristics within the same geography before. So it's not too much of a stretch of the imagination to say, well, some of those characteristics could evolve and combine together to give something completely different. You know, if the Brits have came to Australia and seen a swan with, you know, pink and purple polka dot plumage, well, that is not something that's never been seen before. And that would have been, in my view, kind of a true black swan, which is how I think Taleb really try to mean what a black swan event is. So basically what a cladistics approach is all about saying, and this is where I think we start to drill into the detail a bit. So instead of thinking about our broad homogeneous risk classes, market rates, interest, insurance, operational liquidity, project, all those risk silos, we start to say, well, that's an irrelevant notion. Let's get to the true essence of what risks are. And in this case, biologists are trying to get the true essence of what an animal is. And so you can look at a lamprey, a shark, a salmon, a lizard, and say, you know, which ones of those characteristics do they have? Do they have pair fins, jaws, dermal bones, fin rays, lungs, rasping tongues? And we can allocate a binary measure to whether they have that characteristic or not. And then the question becomes, How do I relate all of those organizations, all of those organisms together in a way that is the simplest way for me to organise that information. And what you're seeing there on the right is a cladogram. It's basically saying the lamprey is more fundamental because it shares less characteristics than a lizard, a salmon, and a shark. I was watching a BBC documentary about a year ago, and the hippopotamus. Who thinks the closest relative of a hippopotamus is a pig? What's the closest relative of a hippopotamus? It's a whale. It's not a pig. You would think it's a pig, but it's not, because it shares more characteristics with a whale than it does a pig. So you can easily see that if you don't have a very clear technique to think about the underlying characteristics, that our natural bias when we think about these organisms or risks can lead us in the wrong direction. So really, cladistics and phylogeny is really a framework which we can use as risk managers to think about the underlying characteristics of risk and think about the emergent properties of those characteristics. So critically, you can apply this technique to both an assessment of ex ante risks, so forward-looking risks, or ex post risks, so actual loss data, if you have it. And so I'll bring you through a couple of case studies very shortly, that basically gives us an insight into where evolution and emerging risks are actually more likely to come from. And so for those of you who in my last session, I showed this slide. This is a particularly good one because derivative trading losses seem to be always occurring, and it's a good case study of rogue traders to say, well, where's the next rogue trading event going to occur? How do we think about how these types of losses, operational losses, how do they evolve over time? Where's the next one going to come from? How do they relate to my business? You know, can I just take an LTCM blindly and say, well, that could apply here? Well, you know, they made a specific error around thinking about the stability of their interrelationships, their correlation matrices that define their strategy. Well, I don't really have that in my business, so it's not really relevant. So you want to get under the skin of these risks. And so that's what we've done here in this case study, and the paper goes through it in a fair bit of detail. So what you're seeing on the left-hand side are all those derivative loss events over the last 30 years. And we didn't do it because we didn't want to bring our own bias to the study. So what we did, we leveraged a CFA paper in 2011 who looked at all those derivative trading losses and basically characterized them, whether they had certain types of characters, like whether they involved fraud, whether it involved fraudulent trading to cover up a problem, trading in excessive limits, was there a failure to segregate functions. Whether or not you believe they're the right categories or not is kind of irrelevant for the case study, because you can make up your own and then assess your own. And then what you can do is, once you run the analysis, you can then start to define and look at your own cladogram of how these risks interrelate. So instead of looking at just the numbers and trying to rank them by severity, you can actually say, well, how do they actually relate to one another? The first thing that strikes you with this cladogram is you've basically got two major clades. So you've basically got two major elements of systemic risk in this type of loss. You've got something that involves fraud, and then you've got something where there's not fraud going on, but it just involves basically people undertaking their normal jobs and things just got out of control and they basically screwed up. So that's where we've got normal trading activity gone wrong, and basically the primary function of that organisation was to undertake trading. And so what you're seeing here is the interrelationships between these types of risks. And critically here, whilst we say these are the most systemic types of characteristics, at the end of the tree, we basically want to look for patterns where you've got a large degree of bifurcation in the characteristics going on. So if you think about the the geographies and the environments in which you get a lot of evolution. Do you get more evolution in the forests, in the tropical forests, or in, you know, in the ice caps, in the poles, or underwater? You get a lot more where there's a lot of energy in the system, where there's a lot of you get a lot more evolution going on, where there's a lot more energy in the system. So that's what we're looking for. We're looking for where there's a lot more energy in the system. And here, UBS, Societe Generale, Codelco, there's a lot more energy in those systems. Those events are related because they share common characteristics, but they seem to be bifurcating a little bit more. So that provides insight into where potentially the next rogue trading event might come from. So at a system level, like if I was a regulator, I'd be very interested in this. If I was a company thinking about rogue trading, I'd be very interested in understanding where that might, where the next characteristics are coming from. Something down, this clade down here is, you can see it's kind of almost hitting a dead end. These types of events are almost going extinct in a way. You know, they might be still happening, but they're very unrelated or disconnected to other types of events that we've seen. And so that gives you a picture of putting in context the relationships between outcomes. Now we think about the characteristics that are driving that. And this gives us insight into what characteristics seem to be involved in a lot of evolution. And in this case, characteristic number 8, which is lacks management control problem. Well, that's a, you know, you could say that's a pretty obvious one, because we would already know, you know, that's so much of our focus from a risk management perspective. But the point here is we've arrived at that conclusion objectively as what we probably can get to. And then furthermore, we can look at what characteristics seem to be co-evolving with number 8. So here there's a 5 and an 8, here there's a 5 and an 8, trading in excess of limits. So those two characteristics tend to be evolving together. So if you've got an organization and you've got this type of characteristic in your business, lacks management control problem, I'd be very worried about that type of risk occurring where people breach limits. So it gives us a way of structurally thinking and identifying those characteristics. And then we can ask, you know, I won't go into the details here, but we can ask even more interesting questions around interdependencies, about how certain outcomes or events relate to others. What characteristics do they share in common? So again, directly getting at this this measure of connectivity and causal drivers across different types of events. I'm going to skip ahead in the interest of time, because there's a lot to get through. Interpreting emerging properties. So one of the key things here is that what you want to look at is these events here. So state of West Virginia is what we call the most centrally connected, almost systemic type of risk. And so the characteristics which define that, I've started to call, that's kind of the core emerging risk narrative. Most emerging risk events are going to incorporate or most likely to incorporate those types of characteristics. And then we can say, well, how is those two events, the state of Virginia and Orange County, how are they related to a broader set of losses across other types of events which you might be interested in for your organization, because you've got that characteristic? And so those characteristics, as we've seen on the cladogram, are more likely to be driving evolution and more likely to join the core narrative and define the narrative for an emerging risk event. So in this case, the single person joining that narrative would be, you know, the definition of a new emerging risk event. So that was on ex post actual losses. So now if I flip it around and look at ex ante losses, I can say, and here's another case study. I'm not going to go through the details, but basically you've got a list of risk and a list of characteristics that have been mapped. And so what we're seeing here is the nature of these might be, you could think of these as risks on your risk register, and these are all your the characteristics of those on your risk register. So there might be causal characteristics, there might be consequence characteristics. And so what you're seeing here is, again, where evolution is driving those types of risks. And you can see here, characteristic number 36, adverse legal and regulatory change, is the most central characteristic to that story. So we would say it is the most systemic characteristic to that story. And again, we can ask the same types of questions. In the interest of time, I'm going to flick ahead now to... So that's kind of giving you a little bit of flavour and hopefully insight into a cladistic type of approach. The other way in which you can think about emerging risks is from a cognitive mapping type of approach. And so there was a paper that our firm presented at the ERM symposium literally just a few weeks ago in Chicago. It actually won an award as the most practical research out there, and it was based upon a case study, a piece of work we did with the UK Pension Protection Fund, which is a quasi-government organisation that basically underwrites the risk of DB pension funds going broke and passing their liabilities onto them. And essentially it involved cognitive mapping approaches to think about the causal drivers that that are involved in defining how that organisation can fail to meet its strategic objectives. And so through assessing the complex set of interconnectivities between all the causal drivers, it gives us a very tangible framework to construct not just scenarios and stress tests, but to actually assess reverse stress tests of the organisation, because we've basically gives us insight into what's meaningful, what's material, what's most causally connected. And an example of how we put that into practice was literally about how to make one of the clients we worked with was had an exposure to Greece. And essentially through a cognitive mapping type of exercise, you can basically kind of get to the point where you can hypothesize what type of scenario is going to eventuate from Greece falling over. So you might have a huge issue around the euro devaluing and capital being constrained. You're not able to inject capital into an operation in that business. So one of the things you can do through the cognitive mapping types of approaches is you can articulate what those key points of sensitivity are to your business strategy, and then essentially construct not just scenarios of how an event like that might play out and how it might impact your business, but also then to design risk mitigation exercise. And in particular for this client, they basically realized after walking them through that scenario, that emerging risk scenario, by taking some preemptive actions now to even though it's going to cost a bit of money and lower profits in the immediate term, but by taking remedial action now to put in capital into that operation so that in the event that Greece does fall over, it's going to be better capitalized than the other entities within that country, that was going to deliver strategic advantage to them. So it's both about pre and post event risk mitigation. I'll move on because there's another way of assessing quantitatively scenarios through Bayesian types of approaches. And again, there's plenty of literature out there that we've put out there and other people have put out there that help us put in place a quantitative framework should we wish to assess the complex set of interdependencies to drive scenarios. But I wanted to really finish on kind of managing emerging risks, because I think this is quite important. I think, again, we kind of need to come back to some of those, think about emerging risks that involve risks that we kind of know about that might evolve a little bit versus almost this, the true kind of unknown unknowns. Because a lot of those A lot of those risks that we already have a pretty good handle on. You could argue longevity risk is a risk that we have a very good handle on. You know, we don't know exactly how it's going to play out with a lot of the emerging techniques, but we can use very much traditional types of risk mitigation approaches there. You know, we've got pretty robust frameworks for assessing them. We've got pretty robust ways of assessing them and holding capital and mitigating them. Strategic risks are an interesting one because, again, you've got emerging risks through, in particular, customer behaviour and through, I guess, industry behaviour, which you can't necessarily get your hand on. And some of those are, you know, you can approach from a traditional risk mitigation perspective, but a lot of them really come down to strategic planning. So again, coming back to some of the discussion yesterday at one of the plenaries, how do you take advantage? And that's really the opportunity that's involved in emerging risk assessment. But then there's, I think, a third category, which is that true unknown unknowns. You know, there's risks out there that you just, you know, no matter what you do, you just haven't seen it. You know, this is the global war, the nuclear type of event. This is the alien types of events that come in. One of my clients actually calls these the buy guns and grow potatoes scenario. You know, that's the only thing you can do to mitigate them.
And gold,
yeah. Interestingly, the same organization has that as a risk mitigation event. But really, when you think about it, all we can really do in those to deal with those types of emerging risk events is to cultivate resilience. Cultivate resilience, organizational resilience. If you think about our bodies are just fantastically evolved to deal with things that it hasn't seen before. You know, we operate well within the confines of what we are capable of operating at. We have excess capacity, both physically, mentally, emotionally, in a whole range of different areas. Our body is an incredibly resilient organism, and facilitating the development of organizational resilience, I think, is one of the keys to being able to cultivate a culture and an organization that's capable of dealing with emerging risks, because you don't really know how they're going to pan out. You know, the monoline insurers who just got absolutely crunched during the financial crisis are great examples of organizations that were completely unresilient, because one thing goes wrong in their organization, they're pretty much dead in the water. So again, diversification, having spare capacity, understanding the dynamics of your organization so that you can build in, you know, additional feedback loops, having processes in place by which the organization learns over time, all these things is a key to actually cultivating organizational resilience to deal with emerging risks. So I'll leave you with a couple of thoughts before opening up to questions. The bottom line is, I think it is possible to spot emerging risks if we have the right framework, and we can do it formally, and we can do it fairly objectively, clearly not completely objectively, but there's ways in which we can kind of formalize that process. The past is helpful, but it's not necessarily predictive. Expert judgment is useful, but not necessarily unbiased. You need to account for those. And think about building scenarios, not just upon, you know, the scenarios that your business operation people and your strategists, you know, are used to thinking about. Well, equity markets tanking, going down overnight by 30%. Well, that's something we all know about. But think about creating scenarios that involve those tipping points between different scales of drivers in your business. And at the end of the day, open up to having the conversation about resilience. This is an area in which we as a profession are going to be doing more work. We as a firm are doing more work in this area, because I think we as a profession have a natural bias towards optimization. You know, we always want to optimize things. And when you think about what we're doing there, in optimizing, we're actually reducing resilience of our organization, because what does that involve? That involves cutting flexibility back to the bare minimum, whether it's a cost base or a process, and that actually reduces resilience. We're just not capable of withstanding shocks to the system. So I think it's a core role of a risk manager to articulate to the business the trade-off between flexibility, which enhances resilience, and optimization, which, you know, which drives the maximization of short-term profits. So with that, I'll hand it over to the floor for questions and any other comments.
Thank you, Josh. Any questions or comments? Yes, sir. Sorry, you have to use the mic. Kent, it's your turn next.
Charles Head, Josh, thank you very much indeed. It's fascinating, and I think it's a really important area for the actuarial profession to pay more attention to. I've got, I guess, one comment and perhaps one question. My comment is, in beginning to sort of identify emerging risks, there is a question which is still, what do you actually do about that? And I think in the complex adaptive systems, one of the things that we have to accept is that you can't know what you can do, if like what will be successful and what won't. And so what I think we will see, and I think this supports some of the comments that you would say around resilience, is organizations have to start, if like what I'll call safe to fail experiments. They'll have to start a range of activities, many of which they know may well fail, but they will not know which ones, and if and when they fail, it has to be safe for the organization. And I guess that's one of the approaches that will be quite different to organizations, which is, again, you know, it's not spotting the one that will work your optimization. It is taking a range of activities, any of which may fail, some of which may quite unexpectedly be much more successful than you think. So that's a comment. My question just goes back early on to sort of complex adaptive systems, and you were talking a bit about risk and biology and language. And one of the things that I believe around this whole area of evolution is reproduction, an important part of the systems. And I haven't worked out for myself, and I wondered if you had, but I didn't see anything on your list around what is the equivalent in reproduction in these risk systems of giving birth to something new. And I wondered whether that's anything that you've given thought to.
I think it's innovation, really, when you look at whether it's product innovation, whether it's risk management innovation at a risk silo level, whether it's a new risk mitigation technique. To me, that's really the, you know, innovation's all about taking independent kind of developments in different areas and kind of bundling them together in a new and in a new way that we haven't seen before to create something that's different and new. That to me is maybe kind of the equivalent analogy to reproduction, and how languages evolve over time as well. I don't know if you saw, there was it was only a week or two ago, there was a fascinating paper that was released in one of the linguistic journals about how they've now able to trace back some of the evolution of the words in certain languages back thousands of years. Like, literally, I thought they could only go back about 1500 years, and now they've gone back like treble the amount. And it's all because of thinking about the you know, how those common characteristics across different languages fail, you know, evolve, relate to one another.
Thank you.
Yeah. And then your other point about learning, I think that's a really fundamental point. You know, if you look at what Google does, you know, they deliberately encourage employees to be creative and come up with new new ideas. And a learning organization is fundamental. You need to have the ability to learn and to fail in a safe way, because that's what we do. As people growing up in our childhoods, as any organism goes from birth to becoming an adult, it's learning all the time, and it's trying to do so in a fail-safe way. Yeah. So promotion of that, I think, is going to promote resilience as well.
Yeah, no, thank you. And I think that learning goes alongside sort of experimental learning rather than just being passed down information. But you're right. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Any other comments or questions? Kent, you rise to the challenge.
Kent Griffin from TAL. This may start out a little more of an observation. I'm not sure where the question is in here. Not having used this sort of analysis very much, what it appears to me to be doing is analysing a very complex system. And in effect, when we're talking about emerging risks, it's potentially talking about how a number of factors interact to create different permutations out of the system. I almost think of that separately to how the system evolves over time, which actually creates truly new risks, which we don't have today. So some of the things we saw in the earlier sessions around what can be done with certain techniques, if you're talking about insurance products, those sort of things. So I guess I'm trying to distinguish from this, how do you build into it, if at all you can, that potential for the system itself to be continually evolving? And I'm thinking back to the biological example here, isn't it? You can take a snapshot in time of what the world is and link everything together on characteristics, but really the world has been an evolution over time, and that snapshot at different times would look different, if that makes sense. So how you actually take that and then sort of work with that in the analysis?
Yeah, I think it's important to realise, and I don't know exactly how best to answer that question, Kent. I think it's important to realise that when it comes to emerging risk, there's no silver bullet, there's no one right way of looking at it. So you kind of need to triangulate it as much as possible with different lenses and different approaches. And I think a cladistics approach is one useful way of thinking about certain types of risks that are subject to that type of evolutionary process. Cognitive mapping approaches are great ways of thinking about those broader kind of systems dynamics issues where you don't necessarily have the data to be able to undertake a detailed analysis. You kind of need a range of those types of approaches to kind of get at what you're referring to as a broader holistic kind of evolutionary process.
I've had the pleasure of sitting through two sessions with Josh back to back, and I was sort of, and I don't know if this sounds silly, but I was sort of thinking about what you were talking about in the last session, using Bayesian techniques where you've got conditional factors coming in and you've got one or two factors and you use those to infer a third. Add to that that we can see things on the horizon. We're not completely sure what they are, but we can see them starting to emerge, and how you bring those sort of conditional aspects into this sort of analysis. It sort of leads you down to something which is, in a very short-term basis, saying, can I actually start to map how things might emerge? And then if they do, how would the interaction actually happen, and would it be significant or not? And you could do it from a defensive perspective, which is protecting against a company failing. Or indeed, you could do it from an opportunistic perspective,
yep,
and say, can I actually target that as a business opportunity? It's a sort, yep, of analytical framework that sits behind what we generally rely on, which is just judgment at the moment,
yeah,
of people saying there's a market opportunity there or there's a market opportunity, yeah, let me try something.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's all about, and I won't take credit for this quote because it came from Rick Shaw. He said this is all about quantifying intuition, and to me it's a little bit more than that. It's about capturing intuition. So instead of just purely relying upon that gut feel that we have as actuaries or broader risk managers or strategic managers, it's actually trying to capture all of that information because it's really, really valuable information, and you know, your perspective is different from mine, which is different to Charles's, but collectively, you know, there's a lot of value in that collective IP. And so combining that in a cognitive mapping framework, if you've got the ability to throw some numbers at it, if you have data, then you can do that and take other types of approaches. If you want to think about trying to build in simple quantitative aspects, then Bayesian approaches are fantastic because they're ways of, you know, bringing in qualitative state-dependent variables and thinking about, well, if my customers behave this way, I'm in this situation, but if my competition, you know, drops their prices, then they're going to behave completely differently and my lapse rate's going to go through the roof, and that's a very conditional Bayesian dependent structure. So you can bring those aspects in and do it in a formal way. So it's about, I completely agree, it's about capturing that intuition that we have and kind of formalizing it in a way that, you know, we traditionally can't do in an actuarial model because we haven't been brought up with those techniques.
Yes.
Andrew Brown, lead first. Josh, in terms of resilience, how do you position that with your clients? I'm particularly interested around the corporate client who's looked at optimization for a long period of time, very much in that world view, and have the challenges of the external market demanding short-term results. How do you go about positioning resilience?
Yeah, that's a huge question.
It costs lots of money.
Yeah, it's a particular challenge if your key stakeholder is an analyst, because analysts are notoriously, you know, fickle and focused on the short term, and you could say the market is as well. Although they're not all like that. I think as risk managers, we're able to at least articulate the trade-offs between optimization on the short term and the implications that has for longer term resilience. And so, you know, this is a particular challenge whenever we see you know, accountants come in and say, well, we need to reduce costs because we just can't afford things. Well, that's fine, but we need to think about the implications that has upon the longer-term resilience of the organisation. So just being able to bring into the discussion that aspect is actually really valuable.
Okay, I'm afraid we're going to have to wind it up because we're about to be evicted. So please join me in thanking Josh for a great presentation.